From NPR and WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks in Boston.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. This is Here and Now. NATO countries are putting troops on standby for a potential Russian attack on Ukraine. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg spoke yesterday.
NATO is a defensive alliance which does not threaten Russia or any other country. But we will always do what is necessary to protect and defend all our allies. And I welcome that allies are stepping up.
Stoltenberg said the risk of conflict remains real, and he called on Moscow to choose diplomacy. NATO allies are also exploring non-military ways to nudge Russia to pull its troops back from Ukrainian borders. And with us now is NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman. And Michelle, what is the latest on NATO's new deployments and why this is happening now?
So what they're doing is they're sending more assets to NATO's eastern flank. Stoltenberg talked about how France is sending troops to Romania. Denmark is sending F-16 fighter jets to Lithuania. And he went on and on. The U.S., has put now 8,500 troops on higher alert to join a NATO response force if NATO decides to activate one. And officials here say that it's all meant really to deter Russian action against Ukraine. What I often hear, Scott, from U.S. officials is that this is exactly what Vladimir Putin says he doesn't want, NATO forces close to Russia's border. And if he doesn't want that, they argue, he should stop threatening Ukraine. So far, this logic has not deterred the Russian leader. And of course, the U.S. has made clear that it's not sending troops to Ukraine to fight. It's sending defensive weapons and moving troops possibly to NATO countries.
Yeah, well, you just said not sending troops there to fight. So what are the other options being discussed as far as sanctions, et cetera?
So one official put it this way in a background call today. He said, gradualism of the past is out. This time we're going to start at the top of the escalation ladder and stay there. So what they're talking about is not, you know, these targeted sanctions anymore on specific Russian officials or businesses. Instead, they're talking about things like export controls to deny Russia some sophisticated items that they can't buy elsewhere. You know, we're talking about technology that they need to develop some of their strategic sectors, such as artificial intelligence and aerospace, for instance. The other thing that's new, Scott, is that the U.S. is talking to gas-producing countries to see if they can step up their supplies to Europe just in case Russia tries to use energy as a weapon of war in this crisis as it's done in the past.
Yeah, well, and we do know natural gas prices are really high in Europe. Is there still hope that diplomacy can head off a Russian invasion?
Well, it's certainly what Secretary of State Antony Blinken is hoping. But, you know, he spoke last night about just how hard it is to deal with Putin. Take a listen.
Part of the challenge that that we have is that, to some extent, the only person who really knows what comes next on the Russian side is President Putin. And I think that, as we've seen him over the years, one thing that he likes to do is to make sure that he creates as many options as possible for himself going forward. And that seems to be one of the things that he's doing now.
And while Russia is keeping all of its options open, as Blinken said, it's also demanding written guarantees that, among other things, Ukraine never becomes part of NATO. Secretary Blinken calls that a non-starter, but he has promised to deliver a paper to Russia this week about what the U.S. is willing to talk about, things like arms control and more transparency in military exercises. And then Blinken says, we'll see how the Russians respond.
Yeah, well, the message from the U.S. is that the allies, the NATO allies, are united. How united are they really?
Well, I'd say they're definitely have some differences in approach. I mean, some countries are actually sending weapons to Ukraine. Germany is not, for instance. U.S. officials say that the sanctions also might not be identical between the U.S. and European allies. Mm. But they say that they are, and this is, again, a quote from this background briefing I listened to today, that they're unified in their intention to impose massive costs should Russia further invade Ukraine.
Okay. And very quickly, Michelle, you are not in Moscow, but following this closely, what do we know about the Russian reaction to all this?
Yeah, I mean, the Kremlin has been accusing the West of stoking all of this, of ratcheting up tensions with all these new NATO deployments. They accuse the West of hysteria. But they are also, you know, stepping up their military drills on the western border with Ukraine. So, you know, both sides are basically trying to show deterrence to the other.
NPR's Michelle Kellerman, thank you.
Thank you.
The mounting tension between Russia and Ukraine and President Biden's effort to find a solution are big tests for the president. He's been struggling to move forward with his ambitious domestic agenda, blocked by Republicans and some members of his own party. So how he handles this foreign policy crisis could end up helping or hurting him on the home front. Let's get some historical perspective on this with Julian Zelizer. He's professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. And Julian, welcome back to the program. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So President Biden just passed the one-year mark. His domestic agenda has hit some resistance. His public approval numbers are down. What's your take on how Biden is prepared to handle this crisis?
Well, he came to office with immense experience in foreign policy, both in terms of knowledge of foreign affairs and also actual experience, both as senator and vice president, in handling these kinds of situations. That said, all the experience in the world we have seen doesn't always prepare a president to handle these kinds of crises in the most effective way. And so the verdict is still out.
So it seems to me there's tension right now between those who say he should be tougher with Russia, but at the same time, there's a sort of sense of national fatigue with foreign adventures after 20 years in Afghanistan, Iraq, and so on. Do you think the president has the right foreign policy team in place to handle this crisis? Is he getting the kind of balanced perspective that a president needs?
Yeah, I think he did bring in a very distinguished team. It certainly could be categorized as some of the best and brightest in terms of foreign policy, once again, both in terms of knowledge and experience. But ultimately, it's up to the president. All the advice in the world doesn't help if the president ultimately makes a mistake. And what we've seen in presidencies like John F. Kennedy in 1961 and 62, is that ultimately success rests on what the president does with the advice rather than just the quality of the advice.
Right. There's a lot of history here, and you're a historian, so I wanted to ask you for some other examples. You mentioned JFK. Other examples of a president facing a full plate of domestic concerns and then to be confronted with a foreign crisis like this. What's the best example of a president who sort of rose to that occasion?
Well, the most successful was FDR, Franklin Roosevelt, who was still trying to grow and recover the economy from the Great Depression in 1941, when the United States is entering into World War II. And that's a case where the president successfully orchestrates the nation through the war to victory and preserves the New Deal programs of the 1930s and actually expands them in certain realms. Such as creating a mass income tax. So he remains still the best example of how you can actually do both.
Mm. So what about someone who really struggled with a foreign challenge that ended up harming his domestic agenda? I'm thinking of President Lyndon Johnson getting sidetracked in a big way with an escalating war in Vietnam.
Yeah, I mean, with Lyndon Johnson, it's a crisis, some would say, of his own creation. He made the decision to expand America's presence in 1965 and 66, right at the time that he was still wrestling with civil rights issues, with poverty, with other sorts of domestic challenges. And the war, in the end, overwhelms everything, destroys his legacy, and undermines his ability to deal with the challenges that he really cared about.
Mm. Jimmy Carter, too, faced a big foreign challenge, unexpected, the 1979 U.S. hostage crisis in Iran, right?
Absolutely. President Carter was trying to deal with the economy, which was facing a combo of unemployment and inflation, as well as an oil crisis, dealing with issues like conservation. And then the Iran hostage crisis would really define and shape much of his final months in office, helping to lead to his defeat. I'd add the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan also happens during this time, and both The hostage crisis and the Soviet invasion, I think, helped to bring down that presidency.
Julian, what's your hope for President Biden then? And what will you be watching for in the days and weeks ahead as he tackles what has become his first major foreign crisis?
Well, we hope that he can achieve and maintain peace and that this doesn't turn into an escalation without putting, allies and allied countries at risk. That's what we hope for. And that he can handle it in such a way that it doesn't increase political tensions on the home front.
All right. And examples from history about how he might do that and some of the pitfalls that he could face. Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Vice President Harris began today the way she normally does, joining the president's daily briefing on intelligence and national security in the Oval Office. And yesterday, Harris reinforced the president's message on Russian aggression toward Ukraine.
We respect the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Ukraine, and we expect that Russia would do the same, and any aggressive action taken by Vladimir Putin will be met with severe consequences.
Thing is, the vice president has seen staff turnover and low poll numbers. So how's she doing entering year two? Eugene Daniels is White House correspondent for Politico. Hi, Eugene.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. So other vice presidents have struggled with this job, you know, being on one hand the background singer, yet at the same time building a policy resume. Would you say, you know, Kamala Harris has had the same issues or some unique challenges?
Both, actually, right? Every vice president has to kind of figure out how to straddle that line, especially the younger ones or ones that think they have a future in politics, of creating a group of people who would support them later, but also making sure that you don't overshadow the boss. She also has all of these other different things that she has to tackle. And obviously, we're talking about the fact that she's the first woman of color in this position, the first woman. And that makes certain things a lot more difficult and a lot different than anyone else. She has her own press corps, right? People like me who are annoying reporters who are constantly badgering her folks about things that she's doing. That's not something that we've seen for other vice presidents, White House aides, and even some of her own staff who were actually really surprised by the level of scrutiny that she's received over that first year.
Well, this scrutiny has come in tandem with poll numbers that, like her boss, are not very good. Kamala Harris was handed a tough issue of border control and immigration in her first year. Last summer, Dylan Corbett, director of the Hope Border Institute in El Paso, Texas, met with the vice president, and he said the situation has gotten worse. Let's take a listen.
It's not enough. We have to overturn the notion that addressing root causes gives us a pass on human rights at the border. And I think that's probably one of the most troubling things that we're going to take away from the first year of this administration.
So immigration border issues was part of Harris's challenge, that she was just saddled with a couple really tough issues on her plate.
No, absolutely. And what's really interesting is her actual job is to handle, he kind of said there, the root causes of migration to the border. So there was this campaign from Republicans especially who started calling her the border czar, something that is not actually correct, right? She's not doing immigration control at the southern border. She's concentrating on the Northern Triangle countries, Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador. And her team doesn't always knock down every single thing that comes out about her. So that stuff kind of is out there and it festers. But, you know, that issue, also voting rights, you know, she had, which she asked for. So these are issues that she has kind of embraced, some that she's worked on for years, some even while she was in the Senate and cares deeply about. But it does come with it, you know, people asking, so what is the progress that is made on these humongous issues?
Eugene, it's been reported that there is a reboot of Kamala Harris's assignments and her image underway. She's been doing more interviews recently. And on NBC's Today show, she recently pushed back on the suggestion that President Biden meant to cast doubt on the next presidential election. Let's take a listen.
And let's not be distracted by the political gamesmanship when what is truly at stake
are issues like whether Americans with disability have the opportunity to vote by mail.
Kamala Harris has a new communications top staffer. What messaging do you expect we'll be hearing from her in her office in the coming weeks, in the coming months?
Yeah, I mean, as much as it is a reboot and or a reset, our staff hates when I use that word, but that is what we're looking at, right? You're looking at how they've taken stock of the first year, some of the challenges they feel like they face, some of the mistakes that they feel like they've made, right? The kinds of things we're going to see is, like you said, a higher clip of her doing interviews. It started in December because they know that people feel like they don't fully know who Kamala Harris is. They also, too, need to share what they feel like she's been working on and what she's been doing. That's partly because Kamala Harris, in every job that she's done, that first year, she kind of likes to keep her head down and do the work. And you talk to old staffers and they say the same thing. But in a national conversation in the world that we live in today, you know, everything's on in front of a camera or on TV. And if it's not there, people feel like it didn't happen. So they know they have to do the White House overall and her staff a better job at letting people know what she's doing.
Well, there is this political reality, Eugene, that you talk about. But there's also the reality that Kamala Harris is a historic figure. First woman of color to hold the office. Ai-Jin Poo of the National Domestic Workers Alliance has met with Harris several times on issues facing women in the workforce. And let's take a listen to what she told NPR's Asma Khalid.
She was really interested in hearing about the direct experiences of women who, frankly, have been really invisible to other administrations and in general in politics.
So, Eugene, how can Kamala Harris leverage this political capital that she does have, first woman of color in this job?
Yeah, she started to do that. She had the first pregnant women mortality conference at the White House. That was her idea, right? That is something she wanted to focus on. So there are all these other, these little things that she's doing of working with different constituency groups that, frankly, President Biden might not have a lot of pull with. And that leverage is going to be something that she's going to use, you know, later on. It's been building over the last year. And so I think this year is a place where you're going to start seeing more and more of that publicly.
Mm-hmm. Eugene Daniels is White House correspondent at Politico and author of the Playbook newsletter. Eugene, thanks as always for the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Throughout the pandemic, Americans have been depending on their local pharmacies for more than just prescriptions. They count on them for masks, COVID-19 tests, and vaccines. But even with the increased business, retail pharmacies, big and small, are closing their doors. Oregon Public Broadcasting's April Ehrlich reports that these shutdowns mean challenges for small towns where options were already limited.
Lisa Rafferty has rheumatoid arthritis and needs to take an anti-inflammatory medicine every day. If she can't get it on time, the consequences are severe.
I'll go 2 to 3 days at the most, and then I'm pretty much, I can't walk.
She lives in Baker City, a small town in eastern Oregon that had one of its four pharmacies close last year. 55-year-old Rafferty says since then, lines at the remaining pharmacies started going out the door.
And it hurts to stand for any length of time to be on my feet. It's a hard cement floor.
Rafferty says some people bring their dinners and eat them in line. Store clerks have to bring out wheelchairs for people who can't stand that long. Last year, the Pacific Northwest retailer, Bi-Mart, announced it was getting out of the pharmacy business, closing nearly 60 pharmacy counters in 3 states. Many of them were in rural areas. And now the pharmacies that remain are picking up the slack.
It happened immediately, like overnight.
Rick Chester owns Medicap Pharmacy in Talent, a small town in southern Oregon. He says business has been hectic since the Bi-Mart closed its pharmacy nearby. Then chain stores like Rite Aid started severely limiting their pharmacy hours, sometimes closing it for weeks straight.
And so everything is just more of a pressure cooker for everybody here. And you don't really know when it's going to end.
Another pressure, insurance companies pushing people toward mail order prescriptions, even though that doesn't always work for people in rural areas. Bi-Mart spokesman Don Lieber says there are several factors that went into the decision to close its pharmacies.
We were really forced to make a decision we never wanted to make.
He says one big issue is affecting pharmacies across the country, increasing fees, specifically from the middlemen that bridge pharmacies and insurance companies, called pharmaceutical benefit managers, or PBMs. Oregon Senator Ron Wyden has had his eye on these companies recently, which he says are charging excessive fees that are pushing smaller pharmacies out of business.
For rural communities in Oregon, this is a five-alarm emergency.
Basically, when someone gets a prescription through an insurance or Medicare plan, the PBM is supposed to reimburse the pharmacy for the drug cost and some overhead. But in recent years, PBMs started decreasing the amount they reimburse when pharmacies don't meet certain sales markers. Wyden has called on Congress to increase its oversight of pharmaceutical benefit managers, and some states like New York have started regulating PBMs at the state level.
The rules are so vague and so inconsistent, they can kind of decide, gee, we really weren't making enough money, so we'll say the pharmacy's inefficient and just throw some more costs at them.
According to a report by the U.S. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, PBMs have increased their fees for Medicare plans by more than 91,000% in the last 2 years. PBM reimbursements have gotten so low that sometimes pharmacies say they actually lose money when they fill prescriptions from certain insurers. And some pharmacies, like the ones at Bi-Mart, just can't make it work financially. The PBM Trade Association disputes that PBMs are the reason for rural pharmacy closures. Regardless, when pharmacies close, people like Lisa Rafferty have an even harder time getting the medicines they need.
I haven't figured out when the best time to come and stand in line would be. I don't want to know because I don't want to do this anymore.
But standing in line is something she and many rural residents will have to get used to as more and more pharmacies close. For NPR News, I'm April Ehrlich in Portland, Oregon.
Comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and your NPR station. From MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software for technical computing and model-based design. MathWorks, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. And BetterHelp, connecting people with a therapist in a private online environment for issues like depression and relationships. 17,000 therapists are available through BetterHelp using a computer or smartphone. BetterHelp.com/public.
It's here and now. The West African nation of Burkina Faso is now without a president and a government. A military coup that began on Sunday escalated yesterday when military leaders said they had ousted the president. It's the latest in a number of coups toppling governments in countries across Africa. To talk more about it, I'm joined by Danielle Paquette. She's West African Bureau Chief for our editorial partners at The Washington Post, and she joins us from a car in Dakar. Danielle, welcome. Good to have you.
Happy to be here.
So you report that military leaders say they overthrew President Roch Kabore to, quote, get back on the right track. What do they mean? What led to this coup?
So the coup that happened this weekend is rooted in a lot of dissatisfaction around the insecurity in the country. Over the last 7 years, while Kabore has been in power, Burkina Faso has transformed from a relatively peaceful farming nation to a battlefield in most of the countryside. Soldiers are saying we do not have the equipment to fight these militants linked to Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. We are tired of these brutal defeats, so much death, more than 2,000 Burkinabes have died in the violence. We want a fresh start. So they went ahead and took the reins after about 36 hours of fighting.
Wow. What are you hearing from citizens in Burkina Faso? How are they reacting to this coup?
So citizens widely support this coup. They are also fed up with the violence and what they perceive as a lack of progress. They're quite unhappy with the help they've received from French forces, who are Burkina Faso's biggest defense ally. And really, they're looking for change, anything that could get them out of that situation they're in right now.
And yet this was a democratically elected president, but Burkina Faso has experienced 8 such actions in the 60 years it's been independent. And according to your reporting, that's the most of any African nation. Is there a reason for this level of instability in the country?
Well, this goes back to the early 60s when Burkina Faso asserted independence from France. The colonial legacy left some power imbalances, lots of inequality that inspired lots of fighting over the years. What's new here is this insecurity situation, an Islamist insurgency that's been upending life over the last 7 years.
Yeah. Well, as we mentioned at the top, the coup in Burkina Faso follows a number of others across the continent, including coups in Mali, in Chad, and Sudan. Why are coups spreading across the continent? Or why does it seem that way anyway?
That is complicated, and different countries have different reasons. In West Africa, what I'm hearing from analysts is the insecurity is making states more fragile, making people more angry, drawing huge protest movements into the streets, which are therefore empowering the military to say, hey, this is our moment to rise up and take over.
And how are Western powers reacting to this, Daniel?
Western powers are not happy at all. You're seeing these moves condemned by the United States, the United Nations, France, of course, the biggest Western ally in many of these countries. They are saying without democracy, these states will continue to become weaker. But the militaries disagree, saying they need to impact change right now. And they don't have time to worry about something like the Constitution.
All right. Well, Danielle Paquette is the West African Bureau Chief of our editorial partners at The Washington Post. She was reporting there from Dakar about the recent coup in Burkina Faso. Danielle, thanks so much for your help today. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
It's Here and Now.
Thousands of federal inmates are being released this month thanks to the First Step Act.
We will start to see more prisoners get out early. My concern is that the color of their skin will not be reflective of fairness.
Why a tool designed to help gauge which inmates are ready is flawed and may be putting people of color at a disadvantage. On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
The U.S. and Europe are intensifying efforts to deter Russia from invading Ukraine. The Pentagon has readied some 8,500 troops for possible deployment to the region. NATO has sent more ships and fighter jets. So what happens next? Well, our next guest suggests a long view of Russia and the former Soviet Union and its history can provide some clues. Anne Applebaum is a staff writer at The Atlantic, and her newest book is Twilight of Democracy, The Seductive Lure of Authoritarianism. Anne, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
Great. So to kind of frame this, I want to get your long view of this moment here. A lot of the conversation about Ukraine has been about Vladimir Putin, how it's important to him that Russia maintain this influence over Ukraine to remove Ukraine from the map, as you have written. But as you see it, does this go much further back to Soviet and pre-Soviet Russia?
There's a very old and long tradition of Russians seeing Ukraine as essentially a colony, dating back to the Tsarist Empire. Stalin actually saw Ukraine as a major problem for him. At the time of the Russian Revolution, the Russian Empire, as it was, broke up into parts. There was a civil war. And for one period during that time, there was a kind of independent government in Ukraine. And for Stalin, this was a huge threat. He saw Ukrainian sovereignty as a threat to the Bolshevik Revolution, as a threat to him personally. And he instigated what turned into a major crackdown on Ukraine and eventually resulted in an artificial famine that killed many people. And the reason I'm telling you all that is because there is an echo in the present, in that Putin sees Ukraine not just as a, you know, as a sort of irritant or a problem the way, you know, lots of countries find their neighbors, you know, bothersome. He sees Ukraine as a kind of existential threat.
Mm-hmm.
If Ukraine were to be a successful independent country, if it were to be a democracy, if it were to be prosperous, if it were to be integrated into Europe, that would be a threat to Putin's own regime because it would pose a kind of ideological challenge. Look, here's a different way of running Ukraine, and that would be a challenge to Russia, and Russians might look at Ukraine and say, hey, we'd like to have that too.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Stalin in that period. You have written a book about this, kind of remind the rest of us about this brief Ukrainian independence moment in the early 20th century and how, as you write, Stalin retaliated, resulting in the famine.
Yeah, so I did write a book about the famine. It's called Red Famine. And one of the things I discovered when researching the famine was that it's not really a history of the famine. It's a, you know, the short years in the early 1930s when the famine actually takes place are only explained by, as I said, this earlier history that Ukraine was a problem for Stalin, that he couldn't tame Ukraine, the Ukrainian peasantry didn't accept the Bolshevik regime. And so he felt he had to somehow crush Ukraine. And one of the tools that he used, he used repression of intellectuals and he arrested many Ukrainians, including Ukrainian communists. But he also organized an artificial famine, which was not the result of, you know, a drought or a food shortage. Literally, food was taken out of people's houses. Mm. And the result was, it's very hard to calculate the precise number of deaths, but it's between 3 and 4 million. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's left a mark in Ukraine's national memory to this day. It's a very important and significant moment. And, you know, most Ukrainians don't remember this as a Russian action. They remember it as a Soviet action. But, you know, Putin, by doing what he's doing now, is certainly evoking that memory once again.
Mm-hmm. You know, as I read this, I thought about the Great Famine in China. I was based in China for a number of years, and an estimated, you know, somewhere between 36 million or 44 million people in China died in the late 50s and early 60s. As you know, my own relatives talked about eating tree bark to survive. At the time, the outside world didn't know. And similarly in Ukraine, the outside world didn't know what was happening at the time. But you also write this was covered up, not just by the Soviets, but with the help of the New York Times.
Yes. Unfortunately, there was a New York Times correspondent in Moscow at the time who did know the famine was unfolding and spoke about it privately, but chose not to write about it and, in fact, chose to kind of mock and belittle one of the other journalists who did write about it. There was a British Welsh journalist called Gareth Jones who went to Ukraine during the middle of the famine. And the New York Times correspondent was called Walter Duranty. He wasn't alone, actually. It should be said that most of the Moscow press corps was at that time, many of them were kind of boosters of the Soviet system, and they wanted to see it succeed. Hmm. But many diplomats, many people in the region, the Catholic Church, many of the Ukraine's neighbors did know there was something happening, but it wasn't well understood. It was something that was taking place far away. You know, it's really analogous to North Korea now. I mean, we know bad things happen there. And that's another reason, though, of course, that Ukraine is very sensitive as to how it is perceived and how its history is perceived, because they know that tragedies there have not necessarily moved Europe and America in the past.
Hmm. Which takes us to today's tension over Ukraine. On this day, as we talk, there is furious diplomacy. There are kind of military preparations. And you have written that the best time to offer Ukraine military support would have been 8 years ago. Why?
Well, 8 years ago was the time of the first Russian invasion of Ukraine. So remember, Russia mm-hmm. has already invaded Ukraine. They invaded Crimea, which they occupied and annexed, and they invaded eastern Ukraine, the two provinces in eastern Ukraine, which they where there's an ongoing war and where there has been a war for 8 years. And so the time to think about reinforcing Ukraine against further Russian incursion was really 2014, 2015, but then over the past, you know, 4 to 5 to 6 years as well. The Obama administration didn't ever take this problem seriously. Obama didn't believe that Russia was a real problem for the United States or a real challenge. And Trump, of course, favored Russia. You know, he tried to use Ukrainian, the military assistance the U.S. has given to Ukraine, he tried to use that as a kind of bargaining chip. If you remember the impeachment, you know, the impeachment trial, he tried to use that as a bargaining chip to get the Ukrainians to give him some fake dirt on Joe Biden. The Biden administration has been pretty good. I mean, there has been a big chunk of military assistance over the past year, you know, but what Ukraine, the kinds of things Ukraine needs, you know, big defensive systems, you know, anti-aircraft systems, you know, anti-tank weapons and all that they still lack quite a lot of it. The Ukrainian army has improved a great deal. It's not what it was in 2014. Nevertheless, the time to think about Russian grand strategy in the region and to have our own strategy in response to it, you know, really was over the last several years and not starting right now.
And finally, you were in Kyiv earlier this month, and you wrote that from Kyiv, the perspective is that the Western attitude toward Russia and its intentions looks naive. Why? Is that because in a lot of the West, leaders have not paid enough attention to this history you write about?
People haven't paid enough attention to the history, and people in particularly in Europe, but also in the United States, they just can't believe that somebody would start a land war in Europe now. That idea belongs to the distant past. The idea of, a cruel autocracy seeking to dominate its neighbors, this, again, seems to them to belong to a different era. And also the degree to which the Russians think about and seek to influence politics in Europe and in the United States also seems to them kind of unreal and impossible. Unfortunately, when you look at what Russia actually does, it's all too real and it's all too possible. But the Western instinct, I think it's maybe a human instinct, is to say this can't be happening. It's not true. And unfortunately, that's harmed our ability to prepare and to think about what Russia might want and how Russia might behave over the next years and even decades. And it's hampered our ability to prepare for exactly the kind of circumstance that we're in now, where there are Russian troops all around the border, where there are clear invasion plans that people in Washington have seen. We still don't know, I should emphasize, whether Putin will go through with this or not. Mm-hmm. Many people also do believe, and there's reason to think that's a possibility, that he's bluffing and this is all a game to get some Western concessions or Ukrainian concessions. But nevertheless, the possibility of a real war remains there. It's still on the table and it has to be taken seriously.
Anne Applebaum is a staff writer at The Atlantic. Anne, thank you so much for the time.
Thanks very much.
You can see it in many American cities, visible evidence of rising homelessness. That's forcing cities to confront a sensitive question. Do unsanctioned homeless camps cause crime? The question is crucial as city leaders come under pressure to clear the camps. NPR's Martin Costi reports.
If you're asking whether unsanctioned homeless camps generate crime, the neighbors of those camps tend to have a ready answer.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Huge theft ring, huge drug ring, prostitution.
That's Scott White in the Ballard neighborhood of Seattle. He's talking about the 70 tents that grew up in the park across the street from his building, allowed to stay there while social workers offered services and tried to coax residents into shelters. It was a months-long process, and he says during that time, the drugstore where he worked nearby was beset by shoplifters. Some of them assaulted him. One sent him to the ER.
And this guy just, boom, got me here. This side of my face was black and blue for like 6 months. It was horrible.
You can hear similar complaints up and down the West Coast. People on Nextdoor talking about following electronic trackers to find their stolen property stashed in a camp, or the surge in bicycle thefts as tracked by the group Bike Index. Co-founder Brian Hance reviews the reports of stolen bikes as they come in.
The phenomenon of the open-air chop shop has certainly, I think, risen with the same terrible problem of homelessness all across America.
People see their stolen bikes or the bike parts being sold online, and Hance says the photos often betray the seller's location.
If you're seeing a bike that is in a pile with many other bikes, leaned up next to a tree, empty 40 ounces, heroin needles, we take all that into account.
So the anecdotal evidence seems clear. And yet, when you talk to the experts, things get murkier. Charles Lanfear is a criminologist and quantitative sociologist, now based at the University of Oxford. He's been working on this very question, do the camps increase crime? And he says it's complicated by confirmation bias.
In the public narrative, there is such a strong association between encampments and crime that it's leading people to assume that any change in property crime is attributable to the tents and structures in their neighborhoods.
Scientifically, a big problem here is just getting accurate counts, because here we're talking about illegal camps, not those that are sanctioned by the city or by nonprofits. This has been such a challenge that Lanfear had shelved his research until he discovered a meticulous census of unsanctioned camps done by a team of researchers at Seattle Pacific University.
The only sort of data set of this kind that I've ever seen in a place where I also have reasonably good data on property crime.
With these data, he's been able to analyze the changes in reported property crime in Seattle alongside the growth of unsanctioned camps. And he's come to this conclusion.
On average, an increase in the number of tents and structures in an area is not associated with any increases in property crime, very close to zero.
But he says this is an average, a citywide result. At a smaller scale, certain camps may well be worse than others. For instance, near downtown, where the drug economy is fueled by shoplifting. This young drug user is peddling a random assortment of six-packs laid out on a used pizza box on the sidewalk.
So how much is the beer?
$4. Would you like to buy a case?
The link between certain unsanctioned camps and crime is obvious to John Scholes, head of the Downtown Seattle Association.
This, in many ways, is a cancer on our downtown retail environments, where the illegal retail trade feeds and sustains an illegal active drug market.
But in liberal cities such as Seattle, these concerns have collided with the latest thinking from activists and academics who oppose clearing camps. Alex Picaro of the University of Miami has studied policing and homelessness for years, and he favors what he calls a tolerance-first approach.
These people need services, just like someone who's sick and needs to go to the doctor, and you have the doctor say, okay, well, this is why you're sick, this is what you need to do. The key is doing that first.
The problem is it takes money and time to get people to leave their tents voluntarily. And in the meantime, the visibility of the criminal activity in the camps can feed public frustration, or worse. This was coverage by local TV station Cairo 7 last summer.
These are photos of what happened when police say a couple went into a South Lake Union homeless camp trying to get stolen items back, and it ended with someone getting killed. Thanks.
I am worried about people taking matters into their own hands.
That's Carol Cummings, a retired suburban police chief who's lived in Seattle for decades. She worries that people have given up reporting many property crimes, which may hold down the official crime statistics even as public frustration builds. She regularly talks to police officers who, she says, are also frustrated by the hands-off approach to the camps.
It's hard because they know that there are people within those encampments that are victims themselves that they're not able to reach out to and help. And I know that might surprise people that an officer might think that, but in fact, that is the truth.
Police know what they see. In this case, they see bad things happening inside the camps as well as around them. Add that to the neighborhood's perceptions of rising crime, and it becomes a tough sell for those who point to the statistics and argue for more tolerance. Martin Costi, NPR News, Seattle.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Anthony Brooks in Boston.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now.